Hello, everybody. Welcome to the live stream. How long have I been saying that we're going to get this started? Too long. Well, 2024 has arrived. I feel like it's been about a year I've been saying this. Got a new iPad. Look at this. Look how little space it takes up on the desk as well. It's not like my big old MacBook. You could literally utilize that as a weapon, whereas this is far more functional. Welcome, everybody. I hope you've enjoyed the very first UFC event of the year. It's been... Feels like it's been a long time between events. It's good to be back. Good to have events rolling again. I've been working very hard over Christmas, as you can imagine. We had a mad year last year with obviously all the PFL stuff and Veronica's fights, and you know, it was a very productive year for us. This year's gonna double that. So I've been over the Christmas and New Year's period, I've been preparing myself for what is to come, trying to get everything in order. So we're ready now. We're ready. Lots of exciting things happening with the PFL. Lots of good things coming up with UFC cards with Anthony Joshua Ngannou. Press conferences tomorrow. I'll be there. Very interesting what's happening with the combat sports world at the moment. There's lots of other things going on as well. I have lots of. Lots of interesting passing conversations, especially now since I've been dealing with, you know, other managers and coaches. I'm speaking to a lot more people in the MMA world than I was before I was doing this fighter operations job. You hear all kinds of stuff that's going on, all kinds of conversations and events that are popping up, and this person's headlining and this person's a free agent and... Lots of movement in the combat sports world, and lots of announcements coming this week as well, from my understanding, which is very exciting. So I'm sure you'll all be excited when this week's out. Let me put it that way. So UFC last night was a lot of fun. We had some really good fights. We had some great finishes. We had a couple of veterans on the card. Of course, Jim Miller. Going into his, you know, 474th UFC fight, and Andrei Arlovsky, like, incredible. Like, if I think back to when I first remember seeing Andrei Arlovsky hit the scene, and he had the kind of the fancy hair with the highlights, looking like, you know, like looking like a backing dancer for Wham or something. He was very much a, you know, he had that kind of style when he first started out, and of course. The teeth on his mouth guard. He was a ferocious individual, and he kind of arrived in a time when the majority of other heavyweights just didn't look like they looked like lazy light heavyweights and middleweights, you know. Whereas he showed up and he was like lean and trim, and he could move well, and you know. And then I was watching him against Wilder, which was it was kind of frustrating, and I know that it's a part of the game to try and. Try and, you know, coax your opponent out of their shell a little bit, but I felt like Arlovsky was playing quite a sensible game. You know, he was using his wisdom and his fight smarts to kind of pick at his opponent. Like, there were a few sequences, I watched it back today, there were a few sequences I skipped back and watched it again, because, you know, even as he's under pressure, when Wilder was swarming, you could see Arlovsky just kind of covering, and like his instincts in the pocket are... It really, really impressive to watch, and it we see it a lot, you know, with the likes, you know, obviously Jim Miller and Arlovsky being a good example, and Glover Teixeira, guys that they've been in the game so long that they're of an age now where their physical attributes, the things that would have gotten by in their early 20s, are now starting to fade a little bit, and now they're having to use their ability to read the situation based on. All of the experience that they've gathered up to that point. I mean, like, I'm kind of jumping around a bit here because I don't really have a plan for this. I was just planning on getting the live stream going and, you know, seeing where we went with it. But given the fact that we had a couple of good fights last night, and the fact that, you know, we had two veterans on the card. So Arlovsky's record, look at that, 59 fights, 34 wins, 23 losses. And you've got to remember, like, I'm gonna scroll back into his career in a minute and just have a moment, because at what point did he step into a high level competition against really high level martial artists? He's probably always been fighting very, very tough individuals. So he's won by knockout 17 times. He's got 3 submissions on his record. But I always remember when he first joined the UFC, there was this, oh my goodness, you got to watch his ground game. He's a very dangerous grappler. And we didn't really, I don't know. It was always kind of there in the background, like it was in the back pocket. If he needed to put on an ankle lock, it was there. But he never really seemed to draw on it too much. He was always a very effective and intelligent striker. Like one of my favorite fights of his is the Travis Brown one, where, I mean, and then you really see the competitive nature of an individual there, because he was fighting someone that he trained with that he didn't really want to fight, but they both got out there and went after it. And the thing that stood out in that fight was Arlovski overthrowing with his cross and then coming back with a back fist. Like he was sweeping it back, and he caught Travis Brown a few times and kind of dazed him a little bit. If you don't remember that fight clearly, go back and watch it. It's one of those heavyweight one round, it couldn't have delivered more than it did kind of fights. Definitely worth a look. Okay, I'm just gonna scroll back. I'm trying to remember the first fight of Andrei Arlovski's that I saw. It was a long, long time ago. I mean, let's have a look here. I mean, Roman Zentsov in his third fight. I know that name probably doesn't mean a great deal to you, but he was a dangerous individual, Roman Zentsov was. So Aaron Brink, UFC 28. UFC 28. He beat him by armbar in just under a minute. And then he fought Rico Rodriguez and Pedro Hizo. So both guys were or went on to be heavyweight champions in the UFC. Rico Rodriguez Suave was one of Tito Ortiz's training partners, very slick grappler, very kind of, you know, like clean shaven, bit of a baby face, slicked his hair back. He was, you know, very, very tricky person to deal with. Very good MMA fighter. And then Pedro Hizo, you will have seen him in people's corners like Jose Aldo, one of the best heavyweight low kickers in mixed martial arts, bar none. And then after that, he got a win over Ian Freeman. And you know, one of the old school, the pioneers of UK mixed martial arts, Ian the Machine Freeman. Trained with him a few times myself. I mean, I could go off on, this is like a history trip already. Ian Freeman, go and watch his fight. Frank May, a good friend of mine, but one of the standout performances of Ian Freeman's career was against a young Frank May in London. It was one of the most iconic moments of my MMA memory, seeing Ian Freeman sitting on the side of the octagon fence at the Royal Albert Hall with his arms up. What a fight. So anyway, the point being, you go through the list of who Arlovski's fought. He's been fighting incredibly tough individuals all the way through. I know every one of these fighters I'm scrolling through, bar maybe a couple. Yeah, I don't know. But it's, you know, I mean, he was outside of the UFC, he was inside of the UFC, fought in World Series of Fighting. You know, what a storied career. Like I feel like it needs to be better recorded as a, I hope someday the UFC go, look at what we've got here in this individual and what they contribute. And same with Jim Miller as well. I mean, the thing is, because mixed martial arts and the UFC is such a young thing relative to other sports, we're kind of create, I mean, obviously all sports are creating history as we're going, but we're moving into a period where we've got history, because there was a time where mixed martial arts didn't really have a history. The history was, you know, no holds barred in Brazil and the kind of showcase theater, pro wrestling type, you know, very borderline, you know, MMA stuff that was going on in Japan. Like there were lots of different things going on, but when MMA became a thing, that for me is when really the true history of the sport started to develop. And you know, there wasn't an Andrei Arlovski because there wasn't a situation where they could have existed. But now, because the sport's been going for so long, and you've got the likes of Jim Miller and Andrei Arlovski, it's amazing to watch their career and watch them progress and to still be fighting and having great performances. I mean, I know Arlovski didn't pick up the decision yesterday, but he was clearly put in a position where he's up against a young up-and-coming fighter that's got a lot of promise. And the you know, not necessarily the hope was, but the trajectory as it's laid out is for the young lion to, you know, take over the position of the veteran. But Orlovsky's one of those anomalies, like Jim Miller, where he's able to persist. It's really quite incredible. What else? Mario Bautista, Ricky Simon, a standout fight, one that's worth young fighters going back and watching the transitions, the decision making. You know, something Veronica pointed out, really, really smart decision making from Bautista to not only defend the takedowns, but also get himself back out into the center where he was then out in the open with space to deal with takedowns and takedown defense. Ricky Simon is persistent. One thing I will say, though, is that, you know, Ricky Simon and Semmelsberger both came out on the wrong ends of decisions and they both cut their mullets off. So that is maybe something that we need to seriously consider. And there, you know, there are a few people that look better with one of those than without, but I do agree with the commentators, Matt Semmelsberger. When he walked out without one, I was like, he's kind of missing something here. What else? Marcus McGee, another really interesting story. Nice striking. Obviously, he's been delayed in his career because of injuries and accidents and stuff. So he's got this maturity and appreciation for, I'm in the UFC. This is an awesome privilege, and I might only have one opportunity here. And he seems to be making very good decisions. I'm interested to see where he goes, but at the same time, I do feel like there's a bit of pressure on his shoulders, and I do think he feels that as well, which is why I think we'll get the best out of him in a short period of time. And the one other fight I wanted to talk about before I start having a chat with you guys a bit more about whatever else you want to talk about is Taylor Lapolis against Farid Bashrat. You know, a really good performance from Bashrat. Good kicking, very, very fast, very loose, really good control once he hit the ground. But it was an interesting fight because there were lots of circumstances which I feel like I don't know whether as MMA continues to progress, whether we're going to see more of these moments in fights or less of them, right? And the moment I'm thinking back to, the one that's in my head particularly, is when Bashrat was in on Lapolis's legs and he was holding on and he knew he had control, but at the same time, Lapolis was posted on one hand and posted on the head of his opponent. So they were kind of in this awkward, like, isometric balance where they both had to, one of them had to make a decision because neither of them would make sense to move, right? If Lapolis scrambled, he would have potentially given his back, or he would have found himself back on his shoulders because Bashrat would have been able to reestablish top position. And if Bashrat had have let go to deal with the post on his neck, he would have most likely released the legs and the hips of Lapolis, in which case he would have had to chase and potentially work the takedown all over again. So they were kind of stuck in this position where there was a moment, and I don't know whether we're going to see more or less of those situations. Like, there's an upcoming fight which Veronica and I have just been talking about on the Picks podcast, which will be out Tuesday, Jamie, yes. And it's the Evloev against Arnold Allen fight. I can imagine that could be very, like, stalemated in certain circumstances. And that, you know, it's just kind of an overall question. I guess I'm throwing it out to you guys as I'm putting it through my MMA processor. I'm thinking to myself, are we going to, like, those moments in the fights where it stops because no one wants to make a move? Like, are we going to see more or less of those in mixed martial arts? Are we going to find it becomes far more of a chess match when we get into those situations where people are like, okay, I'm safe here. I'm going to wait and I'm going to see if they move first. And then when they move, I can go. It's interesting. I see constant evolutions in those scrambling moments in mixed martial arts, and certain people do certain things very, very well, but I don't see them necessarily trickling down into the rest of the sport. So I guess I'm going off on a bit of a mad tangent here. I'm kind of coming around to the idea that being a really good defensive wrestler is always going to end up with you on the back foot at some point in the future of mixed martial arts, because I think you're going to have to be able to turn defense to offense. It kind of goes back to my Corey Sandhagen thing. And one of the reasons why I enjoy watching him so much is because he's so good at turning the fight back on his opponent, even if he loses control for a moment. Like, his fights seem quite chaotic, but that's because, of course, he's got a very diverse game and his opponents are very skilled. So he's having to utilize different components of his skill set to deal with problems that he's up against. But at the same time, if he finds himself in a difficult situation where all of a sudden he's being forced to defend, he defends to the point where he feels like there's a moment where he can attack, and then that forces his opponent to make the decision whether they start to defend or continue with their attack. Anyway, that's been like, 15 minutes of me just talking absolute nonsense at you. We got a few people joined us, Jamie.
Yes.
Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, we've got 240 viewers at the moment.
Hello. That's Jamie on the mic. You can't see him. That's not me doing the ventriloquist thing. So if you've got any questions or anything you want to talk about, anything really, I'm not really bothered. I'll chat with you about whatever you like. But I'm endeavoring to do this every week now. This is going to be my once a week. I'm going to sit and chat with you guys about the fights that have just happened and potentially what's coming up. I'm interested to know your thoughts around Ngannou, Anthony Joshua, and I'm interested to know whether you're interested in that kind of stuff, whether you would rather just boxers box and MMA fighters fight MMA, whether you like the idea of the crossover, whether there's room for some kind of middle ground, hybrid rules, and what would they look like. You know, that's an interesting conversation I would like to have with you guys. So if you've got any thoughts on that, because it's the Anthony Joshua Ngannou press conference coming up. Of course, that, you know, that fight's been announced, and I don't know. It's interesting because I feel like the boxing world are more into it than they were the Fury fight. Maybe it was because the Ngannou fight was potentially getting in the way of the Fury Usyk fight, which I totally understand. If we recreated that situation in mixed martial arts, and you've got, I don't know. Let's just, for argument's sake, for popularity and draw, let's say you've got McGregor and Khabib. They're destined to clash. One's the champion, one's the interim champion, and all of a sudden Floyd Mayweather shows up 0-0 in mixed martial arts and decides that he's going to step in and fight McGregor first for the interim. Like that, I kind of get it, because like from an MMA fan's perspective, I'm like, I need to see these two guys fight. I need to see that problem resolved before you bring any other situation into it. And the Ngannou being brought into the situation and obscuring the potential of Fury versus Usyk, that seemed to be a very divisive in the boxing world. Whereas this, it feels different, because I feel like the jury's kind of out on Anthony Joshua a little bit. I don't know whether people know what his potential is or where it is now, because I don't know whether they're 100% sure that he's going to have the, I don't know. I don't know the guy, so I'm only judging based on what I've seen and what you guys have seen. But, you know, those Tyson Fury types of situations are very, very high pressure. And I'm not sure whether he would be able to deal with that, or at least he's not shown me that so far. So I feel like the boxing world are more invested in this fight because they're not as concerned about where Anthony Joshua's future goes, and they're more confident now they've had a look at Ngannou that Anthony Joshua is going to be able to do the job. And I'm, you know, on paper you look at it and you go, well, yeah, well, of course Anthony Joshua should be able to box his face off, but there are certain other things that we have to consider, and the psychological factor is one of them. The weight that he's going to be on Anthony Joshua's shoulders when he wakes up that morning, that's something that I feel must have hit Tyson Fury, and he carries it so well because he's a, you know, he's a rock star when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I don't know. I can imagine the walk out to the ring where Anthony Joshua is not exactly sure what he's going to be up against. He's going to feel that power at some point, potentially through his gloves if he's got his arms up. If he locks up with Ngannou, what's that kind of strength and power going to feel like? Is it going to feel like something he can handle? Because of course, you know, Anthony Joshua is a very well-conditioned athlete, and he will come in supremely conditioned, because now the element of surprise, of course, is not in Ngannou's favour. Where are we at, Jamie?
Yeah, so the a few people have mentioned the, obviously going back to last night's fight, Ankalaev potentially getting the next title shot against Poatan. You know, how that will play out. You know, Poatan's not really faced a grappler per se yet, so
yeah. But the thing is, like, Ankalaev's not really a grappler. He can grapple, but it's not his choice. He's not got any submissions on his record. No, 19 wins, 11 by knockout, no submissions, and the one loss on his record, of course, is a loss by submission. I'm not saying that he wouldn't go in there and take Alex Pereira down and wouldn't be able to win in that range, because absolutely, I think his grappling skills are, you know, master of sport in combat sambo. I think it's interesting, though, that he much prefers to fight in the striking range. And, you know, he dealt with Johnny Walker fairly well in that range, I felt. And Johnny Walker's a big, powerful individual. Of course, he doesn't have the same kind of skill set that Alex Pereira does. But at the same time, you know, can he shut down Alex Pereira's game a little bit with the threat, potentially, of a takedown? I did see something. Am I remembering things incorrectly? But did I see something where he said that he would stay... keep it standing with Pereira.
Yeah, I think that was Glover Teixeira put a tweet out congratulating him.
Oh, did he?
And he said, "I promise not to take your boy down," or something.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to see it. Absolutely, I'd like to see it. Alex Pereira's in a weird situation because he's terrifying, but then you feel like there's going to be someone in one of the divisions that could make him look really out of place, right? Like, It could be Bo Nickel, you know. It could be someone like that. It could be, I mean, who have we got at light heavyweight that could do that to him? I would love to watch Pereira and Glover Teixeira spar. Like, closed room, closed doors. They're play sparring, but they're letting things go a little bit. And because obviously, you know, the never outshine the master thing. I would imagine that Pereira's got a huge amount of respect for Teixeira, but at the same time, I bet it gets quite competitive at times. And I bet Glover Teixeira can really hustle him up against the wall and dirty box with him, make him uncomfortable. Love to watch it. Like, I mean, it's a good division if you're a striker right now. Like, you look down this division and, like, nobody's standing out. As I mean, like Nikita Krylov, I would say, is probably, aside from Jan Błachowicz, he's most likely to be taking people down. Like, most of the people in that division are predominantly strikers, you know? Like, Rakic, Walker, Roundtree, Özdemir. Alonzo Menafield down at number 12, but... No, I think that's the... I think that's the fight to make, isn't it? I think that's the fight to make, for sure.
So, just an interesting question to come up from Pro Fights Info. How do you think Kevin Holland and MVP...
Oh, man.
It's probably jumping around a bit, but...
No,
it was a good
jump around.
Yeah.
House of Pain. What a fight that is going to be. I mean, well... Well, what we know we're going to get from Kevin Holland is a little bit of wildness and a little bit of chaos, but a lot of good fighting at range. And as he flows through ranges and starts tangling up with people, it can be very dangerous with his submissions, with his striking off his back, as we know. The thing with MVP, and this is really where I'm excited that he signed with the UFC, because we're really going to get to see what his potential is. And The truth is, he couldn't have gone anywhere else and had the same kind of impact on his career. The UFC is the place for him to be, to define his legacy. And I am super excited for him to be there, because I feel like he can absolutely hang with anybody in the welterweight division. Like, we've been down to London shoot, watched him spar. I've spoken to Jimmy Warled when he's been down to shoot and come back after a sparring session. And, you know, like, Jimmy's been around the world, sparred with lots of people, so have I. And you just kind of, like, when Jimmy looks at me and he goes, he is good. I believe him. I absolutely believe him. And then I go down and watch him spar myself against some of the top welterweights around. And his distance management, his ability to judge and predict his opponents. And then the presence that he has as well, which is something that can be very underappreciated until you come up against it. And this is something that, of course, Chimaev has got as well. A different kind of presence with MVP, though. It's a presence like there's like this kind of calm, casual 30% smile on his face all the time. Like he's waiting for you to make the next move, and you're preoccupied with trying to figure out what that move is, so you don't walk onto a foot or run onto a knee. I mean, this is the other thing with the psychological impact is when you've done serious damage to somebody, right? Like, would Ngannou be as terrifying if you'd not seen him land knockouts like he did against Overeem, right? I have a picture in the MVP file in my brain that when someone goes MVP, I have a picture that comes up. There's an X-ray of Cyborg's head that's caved in. Like, that is constantly associated with MVP in my brain. And I can't imagine there are many other people that have seen that and will somehow lose or discard that bit of information, especially if it's a potential opponent. Because if you're Kevin Holland, you've got to be very, very cautious what you do with your head all the time, especially if it's heading in any direction towards the feet or knees of MVP. Because his ability to read and predict is quite special. And I think that, you know, I mean, there are a lot of other fighters, many easier matchups for MVP in the UFC. The fact that they've given him Kevin Holland, like, it shows that they really want a martial arts extravaganza, because that's what both of these guys are all about. You know, you've got precision and skill and calculation on one side with MVP, and then you've got the unpredictable flow and chaos of Kevin Holland on the other. It's going to be a fascinating fight, and I cannot wait to see MVP. It feels kind of long overdue, to be honest. I feel like we should have seen him, you know, step into the UFC a couple of three fights ago and, you know, start that journey. I'm excited. But I don't like the fact that he's in the same division as Leon, I'll be honest. But, you know, well, it's a hell of a fight. I'm glad it's on the table, at least. Let me put it that way. Imagine that in Wembley. Imagine that in... Was MVP calling for it?
Oh, what, for the Leon fight?
Yeah.
He hasn't really... I don't think he's really commented
Did
on it.
Not? I thought I no. saw something where MVP had called for... had said about bringing the fight back to the UK. I mean, it would be massive, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I know Leon obviously is probably pushing for like a Birmingham card or
yeah.
UK card.
Yeah.
We actually have another question from Mr. James Mystery.
Oh, Mystery.
So going back to last night, do you think Dana likes Ankalaev? It never seems to go his way behind the scenes, especially after the title shot with Jan.
You know, I think the thing is with that, that's a great question, Mystery. As always, we know you with your great questions. I don't necessarily think Dana dislikes him. I don't really think Dana takes a dislike into any fighters unless he has a very specific reason to. I think what he does is he looks at everybody through a promoter lens, and I think although there is the Khabib demographic is there, and the Islam Makhachev demographic is there, they could all potentially buy into the journey of Ankalaev. He doesn't quite have that same type of draw, from what I can tell. And I I'm open to be corrected if I'm wrong, but I feel like Dana looks at him from a promotional perspective and sees that there's not the same level of marketability, especially because, you know, if you think about the light heavyweight division, it was like back in the days when I was fighting amateur, the light heavyweight division, when it was Tito and Chuck and Randy, like, it was the pinnacle of the sport. Everything that mattered really seemed to be like in the light heavyweight division, all the biggest names and the biggest stars. And then, of course, that's John Jones's division. That's where we had all the drama with Daniel Cormier. It's always been such a strong and powerful division. And then, you know, we've had a few fighters that, I mean, obviously with Poatan being up there, I think that's going to really invigorate the division. But it's a division of big characters. And although Ankalaev can potentially be the person that can grab the belt and hold it and hold everybody else off, he may not quite reach the same types of heights as the other characters that they've had at light heavyweight. That's maybe just my take on it, but I feel like Dana will always look at someone and go, okay, how do they stack up numbers wise and money wise in the fans' perspective? Might be that. What do people think about Poatan moving up and fighting Tom Aspinall? Do you think he's got fights at light heavyweight? At heavyweight, I mean, do you think he's like at what point does his power kind of level out? Like punch for punch, can he hang with Tom Aspinall power wise? That's the question. Because I don't know. I mean, obviously he was able to make middleweight, even though he was massive at that weight class. Light heavyweight seems to fit him perfectly. Heavyweight, it's kind of like the McGregor situation, isn't it? Moving up weight classes, like he could make featherweight. Lightweight was perfect. Welterweight, he was a little bit too, you know, maybe a little bit slower and not quite as comfortable. What's he going to look like at middleweight if that actually happens? I don't know. But I like his confidence, certainly. I like the fact that he's not only stepped into mixed martial arts and gone almost immediately for the top of the sport, even after picking up a loss in his first fight, you know, that's something that must have been a shock to the system. And a real learning experience for him. I don't know. I mean, where does he top out? I feel like he can dominate the light heavyweight division as long as he's getting the right matchups and he's not dealing with people that are going to really test his ground game. And that might give him enough time to develop enough of a you know, an anti-wrestling, anti-jiu-jitsu game to be able to force people to deal with the striking that he's already got. I don't know. Certainly, though, Tom Aspinall should be getting the John Jones or the Stipe Miocic fight. That's got to be happening. Do you save me more questions, Jamie?
Sorry, yeah. The one question again, obviously relating to the Aspinall Jones fight, if that ever does happen, you know, who do you think comes out on top? Do you think Tom? John will be able to take him to deep waters, drown him, or do you think Tom will catch him with his speed and an early finish?
I honestly don't know if there's anybody else, so I'm just going to pull the heavyweight division up now. I can't really think of anybody else that's going to be a challenge to Tom Aspinall in the same way that John Jones could. I mean, I look down this division and like, I feel like the combination that Aspinall brings with his speed and his power, as well as his fight IQ, and he's just this kind of calm confidence that he has, where he's not at all agitated. He doesn't feel like he has to go, but when he does go, he flows through his technique so beautifully. It's going to be someone like John Jones that's going to have put the work in the build up to the fight to be able to stifle that. And you know, one of the reasons why I would love to see the fight and why I'm hoping we do get it is because I want to see how John Jones deals with that problem. Like, what is the solution to Tom Aspinall and the speed that he brings to the table? Because it's a problem that John Jones has potentially not really had to deal with before. He's had to deal with people that are fast, of course. He's had to deal with big punchers. But Aspinall does seem to be a rather unique combination for the size. He has the speed and the physicality of someone like a Cyril Gane, but he has this power that is undeniable. And then, you know, we know he's got a ground game that he's not really had to utilize at all. Where does that compare with John Jones? You know, where in Tom Aspinall's story is John Jones? You know, is he the final boss, or is he one of the people that Tom Aspinall beats on his way to, you know, fulfilling his potential and cementing his legacy? That to me honestly seems more likely now, because time catches up with everybody. You know, John Jones he's struggling so much with consistency. Like you've got to wonder how long John Jones is going to continue fighting for. Where's the motivation to continue fighting? Like if he starts training camp and it goes perfectly and we get another fight out of him, brilliantly. But what if he starts training camp after this pectoral injury and he has another injury, right? Or what if he has something that just makes training camp miserable enough for him to not have a very good performance and not feel confident going into a fight against Stipe Miocic if that fight happens? like, there's so many things up in the air, and like, as I would love to see John Jones back in there. And I understand the holding up of the heavyweight division, because we want Jones against Stipe. But I'm kind of over this attachment to the belts, because the interim belts feel like they've kind of watered it down a little bit for me. Like, Jones v. Miocic is Jones v. Miocic. You can hang a bit of gold on it if you like, but it's the fight that is fascinating for me. And if it means that we're going to have an interim heavyweight champion defending his belt against someone that's not one of those two, it's not logical to me. I would rather the heavyweight division continue, because these two guys are only going to drift further away into history and take the heavyweight belt with them while it's stagnant. Yeah, that's just my opinion anyway. I'm not a massive fan of interim belts. I'm not against the idea. I certainly think that there's a time and a place for it. But I don't know. Any other questions, Jamie? We've got a war room for you. We've got a Picks podcast is back. I'm planning on doing this once a week on a Sunday. What else? Jamie's got his mic. He's putting pressure on him now. I've got to give these guys a shout out. I've got to give Outlaw Rum a shout out. So I received this just before Christmas, and I've just opened it now. I was fortunate enough to have a sample of it, so I already know how wonderful it is. This bottle is one of 1,004. This is Rachel's cask. It's rum distilled in sherry casks, so it has a lovely sweetness to it. Anyway, you know, I've got good friends over there at Outlaw Rum. They make fantastic products, and that is their new release, a limited edition release. So if you do want some, go and get it quick, because it does normally hustle out the door pretty fast. They're winning all kinds of awards at the moment, Outlaw Rum, so it's drawing a lot of attention to these rather unique projects that they're working on.
So there's a few questions coming in, but I just wanted to ask you really, you know, regarding the PFL and stuff this year, and, you know, what are you looking forward to? And
Champs v Champs.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to Champs v Champs. I've seen some of the cards in process, and I know some of the matchups that are being discussed. And I mean, there are so many different ways you can combine these rosters. There's a lot of interesting things going on. And then, you know, the Bellator presence in the PFL, and potentially PFL fighters having a presence in Bellator is going to be exciting. I wish I could tell you more, because there's lots to tell you, but it's going to be a big week for combat sports generally this week. There's lots of announcements this week, and they're going to be very interesting. So stay tuned for that. But yeah, I'm working most of the day on signing fighters and making matches at the moment for a variety of different shows. So yeah, you're going to be spoiled for choice with what to watch. Let me tell you that. You know, Ben, dark room. Yeah, I might do a dark room again. I haven't done one of those for a while. I kind of feel like going back into some older fights, because there were some fighters that I used to watch that, like, I mean, they were key. It was like a battery pack of inspiration before training. I would watch their fights, and I would try and kind of understand their energy when they were stepping into the fight, understand what they were trying to do, what kind of presence they must have had when you were facing them. And there's some really good fights back in the day, old fights. Enson Inoue, obviously, is someone I reference quite a lot. Of course, you guys will know Ramon Dekkers, but, you know, Rumen Asato, another one of my favorites I used to watch. I kind of want to go back and do some of the older stuff, which I might get into at some point. Yeah.
If I could ask you another question. This week, Davison Figueiredo and Cody Garbrandt got announced as well for UFC 300.
Yeah.
So what do you think to that? And, you know, Figueiredo in bantamweight division now.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I like the matchup. My concern for Cody is does he want to be, you know, being tested by Davison Figueiredo's power when he's not going through. Like, I feel like he's dangerous as a flyweight, but I feel like if you take away that process of making the weight, he's just going to be so much more. He's going to be faster. He's going to be fresher. He's not going to be as you know, as depleted as he would have been if he was fighting at flyweight. And that, I think, just means that he's going to be faster. And that power is, you know, that's a natural thing that he's got. And he accentuates it by being in good condition for the weight class. He's a scary individual, Davison Figueiredo. And we know what his grappling skills are like as well. My concern is that Cody Garbrandt's going to feel like, well, he's coming up to my weight class. I'm going to stand my ground here. I'm going to show him who's boss, and I'm going to be the bigger guy. And there's going to be a willingness to stand in the pocket and go power for power. And although Cody Garbrandt, he's got incredible power and good boxing skills, he tends to get caught when he's throwing himself. And this is where Figueiredo being tight and impact and compact and on the inside and throwing with mean intentions. It's a good matchup. It really, really is. I'm relieved that Figueiredo's going up, because I feel like we're going to get a better version of him at this weight class. But we'll see.
It's a good question from Potcake365.
Yeah.
If you were starting off again, what martial art would you start with, or would you go directly to MMA?
That's a good question. I mean, the options now for just going directly into MMA is like that'd be the clear thing to do, especially if the plan was to do MMA. Like, I don't know. I mean, it depends on what your motivation is, isn't it? If you want to be an MMA fighter, then start with MMA. If you're young and you've got access to a wrestling program at school, or there's a good jiu-jitsu school nearby, then definitely get involved in that as well. The level of competition that you'll get in a wrestling program is gonna give you that real life feeling of pressure in a live situation. And anything where you're going through the process of learning a skill set that is relevant to combat sports, even if it's not directly relevant, you know, like you look through Bruce Lee's works and he drew on everything from fencing to dancing, you know, there's something to be learned. But if your goal is to be an MMA fighter, then you can most likely find an MMA school that can at least get you started off doing the right fundamentals. And there's so much to be learned online as well. There's so much good information, good Instagram channels out there where you can pick things up and watch people. There's loads and loads of information now that is there for free. When I first started martial arts, there was no intention of doing it as a profession in a sporting context, because it wasn't an option, right? Like, Taekwondo was my first martial art, and that became an Olympic sport while I was competing. So there was never even the goal of, well, I'll go to the Olympics, I'll do something as an amateur. It was, my purpose was always, why, I want to learn how to fight so I can defend myself. And through that, I went through the process of recruiting martial arts with that in mind, not with what am I going to need in an MMA fight, because it just, that wasn't on my radar. Which I think is interesting, because especially, you know, when I'm talking to old school coaches and stuff, I get this same kind of vibe from them, where like there were certain other things that were programmed into me as a martial artist, like, you know, you've got to be aware of your surroundings and what can be used as a weapon and what if there are more than one person. All these different things were tangible questions that were asked on my martial arts journey. But then if you start from an MMA perspective, that's all kind of, you know, the space is the arena that you're working in. And the only thing you have to watch out for, aside from your opponent, is potentially banging into the referee. And that's more their fault than anything else. So I don't know. It's a different thing. I did Taekwondo and boxing to Muay Thai with boxing mixed in. And then I started grappling arts, and I did a little bits of grappling here and there, but it was always like judo or traditional jiu-jitsu, and wasn't the same kind of grappling that we see now. So I guess options are different now. I liked my process of going through and learning different martial arts in that process, and then MMA becoming a thing, and me then tailoring my training to that, because that when MMA became a thing, that tended to suit me more, I think, because I wanted to test it and I didn't want to get myself arrested. So I needed a sporting context in order to test it. I mean, for me, if I'm going, look, you need something that's going to give you confidence to be able to walk the streets. And if you need to defend yourself, I would honestly always say Muay Thai. I would always say Muay Thai. And I know a lot of people are going to be, jiu-jitsu, you need to be able to control people, et cetera, and blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. My argument for that is that jiu-jitsu is very effective if you know for sure you're dealing with one person. If you're dealing with a multitude of people, you might have to deal with one person before the next one approaches. And that's why the viciousness of Muay Thai, it, for me, was always, I don't know. It suited my needs more, you could say. Yeah. Any more questions, Jamie? I'm going to start wrapping this in a minute. I think I'm about ready for a tea.
There was just talks about Corey Sandhagen.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think's next for him? You know, after I think he's currently got an injury and he's recovering, but from Young Spicy, what do you think's next for Corey Sandhagen?
What's he injured with? Do you know? Yeah, I'm not sure what he's injured with. Is that what it is? I'm a big fan of Corey Sandhagen. As I said earlier on in the stream, I like the fact that he has this intensity to his game that's also got a level of calculation to it. So you get someone that is proactively trying to find a finish. They're actively trying to set traps, but at the same time, they're not holding themselves under such control that they're not allowing the fight to play out. Like, he does find himself in dangerous situations, and that's why I would always put him in there against anybody above him, because on the roll of a dice, he's going to change the fight around in his direction and catch them with something. Like, that setup that he landed on Marlon Moraes was beautiful, right? Like, what he recognized was he went for a shot to the body, and he went for a back kick to the body, and Marlon Moraes was sweeping the back kick out of the way. So Marlon Moraes was recognizing that as Corey Sandhagen was turning his shoulders to throw the back kick, that the back kick was coming into his midsection. And Sandhagen recognized this trait that he'd managed to instill in Marlon Moraes and switched it for the hook kick. It was a beautiful finish. I feel like Sandhagen's got the skills to beat anybody in this division. I feel like him against O'Malley is, you know, I mean, a very evenly matched and competitive fight. It's the issues that Sandhagen's going to have is against the likes of Dvalishvili, that's going to be, you know, in on his legs and smothering him and slowing his creativity down. But for me, like for entertainment value, that there aren't many better than Corey Sandhagen in the division. I'm a big fan, of course, of Peter Yan, but then Peter Yan can. I don't know. I feel like Peter Yan can get frustrated, and he can allow people to outwork him and let his frustration kind of take over a little bit. Like, I saw it back in the old ACA days against Magomed Magomedov, when he was, what is it, fifth round, he headbutted him. You know, same thing with the Aljamain Sterling. I felt like there was some frustration mixed in there, and, you know, we could debate that until the end of the day, but I don't know. For me, Corey Sandhagen is like a... He's a bit of a mad professor. There's a chaos to him, but at the same time, there's a high level of calculation. And yeah, if you give him enough runs at the same problem, he's going to solve it eventually. If you gave him Aljamain Sterling or Peter Yan enough times, he's going to solve that problem. Yeah. Did that answer the question? I kind of just went off on one about Corey Sandhagen, really. Just kind of chatting about. Oh, Jamie, who would you like to see Veronica fight next? I am staying out of that. Hey, we just wait until the name comes through, and then we pull them apart. We pull them apart.
There was one just on. There's a lot of talk about Jim Miller fighting at UFC 300.
Torn tricep. That's what Tarzan Strickland's just put in the group about Sanhagen.
Corey, yeah.
Okay, sorry, carry on.
Yeah, a lot of talk about Jim Miller fighting on UFC 300. People talking about Paul Felder as a potential opponent, but who would you say, be a good opponent for Jim Miller?
Man, I don't know. Who would be a good opponent for Jim Miller?
I mean, there's talks. He's mentioned like people like Ferguson, Matt Browns, those kind of people. But he also said he'd take Paddy.
Matt Brown, what a welterweight.
Yeah. That, I mean, he mentioned it.
I think he'd be so small compared to Matt Brown. I'd like to see him fight a veteran. I thought the Benitez matchup made sense. It's a shame they can't do something like mad left field, like, you know, Shinya Aoki or someone like that, you know? Someone that's just a bit mad and left field. Or bring back Jens Pulver. Yeah. I don't know. It's a good question here I've just seen, actually. Where we go? Jaideep. What would you have done differently in preparation? Oh, where did it go? Why does the chat do that? Basically, the question was, what would I have done differently in my preparation with the GSP fight? Knowing what I know now. And I don't know, because I kind of, like, if there was an opportunity to go back in history and change anything, I just wouldn't, because no matter what I did in that training camp, I'd not done the right things in my martial arts journey up until that point to be competitive in a mixed martial arts contest with GSP. Like, the thing is, at the start of the training camp, training camp was 14 weeks long for that fight. It was stupid, but I couldn't wait to start training camp. I felt like I needed all the time I could get. So I don't know if I'd change anything, really. Like, I did everything I could have done. What I would have liked, what would probably be a better answer to your question is, what would I have done if I'd have got a second chance? Because I would have done a lot of things differently that time around. I would have spent a lot more time in the US for that training camp. I would have probably had a different approach to the problems I was going to deal with GSP. I invested too much in takedown offense, and I just wasn't able to get anything off. What I needed to do was to invest more in my ability to threaten off my back and scramble from my back. It's the thing is, like, there weren't at the time the facilities around to be able to go and find the information that I needed without, you know, uprooting my whole training camp and my, you know, I'll bring my S&C coach and my blah, 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 and this and that. And there just wasn't the time or the finances to do that. So things are different now. You could go to a super gym and, you know, get everything you need on one mat, but it was different then. It was different then. And it was a fantastic experience as well, because it gave me an opportunity to show my determination, because I had nothing else to offer him at the time. You know, it was really good going up to train with him, though, and watching how he put his training camps together, because they were so well thought out and well planned, and he had a really good team of people around him and, you know, invested well in himself. You know, that was something that you can always see in GSP's preparation, is that he took the money that he was making from being champion and reinvested it into his own learning. And the things that he could do to make him better in training camp, whether it was bringing three black belts up from Henzo Gracie's in New York to stay with him for the week or whatever. Like, there were lots of things that he did, very, very smart things that he did. And, you know, it was a great, great learning experience, a real honor to be able to step in there against him. And if I'd have, and you know, obviously, because like when my career ended, I was on a 2-fight win streak. So I thought to myself, I mean, most of you probably don't even remember this. So my last fight was in the September, and in the April of the following year, I was due to fight Matt Brown in California. And that would have been would have been my third win in a row, because of course I was intending on winning it. And that for me felt like I was like, okay, so win this one, then probably two more, maybe a third on the top of that. And then I'm going to find myself in a situation where I might get another opportunity at the belt. And it just kind of wasn't to be. But I wouldn't change anything about what I did. I wish I knew then what I know now, of course, but you know, that's a different thing entirely. Any predictions for UFC champions in 2024? Okay, let me have a quick look at the divisions. Let's have a look. Maybe not 2024, maybe the beginning of 2025, but I think we're going to see Muhammad Mokaev certainly up there in a title shot. Certainly think he's got that trajectory. You know, I wouldn't at all be surprised if we see Figueiredo pick up the bantamweight belt. I could see him carving his way through a couple of people and putting one on O'Malley's chin and taking that belt off him. Man, Movsar Evloev, like I know, he's fighting Arnold Allen coming up, and you'll watch the Picks podcast, and you'll see my thought process behind that. I'm a big fan of Arnold Allen as a fighter and as an individual. Movsar Evloev, I feel like he's a nightmare of a fight for anybody. He's currently at number 9, so you've got to think if he beats Arnold Allen, he's going to find himself up there, you know, on his way past Chikadze, Keita, Josh Emmett, like Ilya Topuria's up there, but like I fancy Movsar Evloev's chances against any of those guys with that Greco style that he's got. He'd be a nightmare of an opponent for people. Who else? I feel like you know, part of the lightweight division's going to be on their way out of their careers soon as well. I feel like we're going to have a real change in the guard at lightweight. Benoit St. Denis got a really good opportunity against Poirier. That's a hell of a fight. And he's starting as the favourite. Did I see that right? Yeah. Fazeev, he's going to be on his way up. Gamrot's going to be on his way up. Oh, who else? I'm just scanning the divisions now.
I was going to, because it got announced that Izzy's going to be cage side for Strickland Duplessis.
Okay.
So do you see, you know, if Izzy makes the comeback sooner than what he said, do you ever see him being champion again?
Izzy, I think, yeah. I think for sure. I think Izzy... I think, especially if he's had enough time off, my concern is that he might be rushing back because he wants his belt back. And I feel like he's going to want to right the wrong. And I certainly feel like he's got the skills to do it. I just feel like he needs to make sure he takes the right amount of time to be right mentally to do it, you know? I kind of feel like Strickland's going to beat Duplessis, and I think Adesanya gets his belt back off Strickland. Yeah. But, you know, still, like, you throw Chimaev in that mix as well, and there's a few interesting fighters in that division on their way up. There's no one that really excites me massively in the other divisions, if I'm honest. Oh, that's, the women's bantamweight fight, Raquel Pennington against Mayra Bueno-Silva is going to be good. It'll be nice to see the bantamweight belt on somebody again. It's always nice to have someone to chase if you're in that division. All right. Any more questions, Jamie? Any more questions, or should we start wrapping this up?
We've got a slightly unrelated question.
Yep.
From MMA. From Pro Fights Info again.
I've just seen that question.
Yeah.
That's a good question. What's your favorite time period in history to read about? I like the Peloponnesian Wars. I'm not much of a fan of stuff when firearms start coming into it. Maybe that was because when I was at school, it was First World War, Second World War. I'm much more about pitched battles history. I had a really good, in fact, this can be my last thought and we'll leave it there. I had a really, really good history teacher. His name was Mr. McLaren, and he was a little small Scottish guy with grey hair and a grey moustache, and he had glasses on and a glass eye, and he was the best storyteller. And I don't know as I would love history as much if I'd not had that particular teacher, right? And this can be my parting thought, because I've had some really good conversations over the past few months with some really incredible teachers. I've been very, very fortunate over my years to train under some of the best people that I've ever met and that I know are in existence, not only in the mixed martial arts and martial arts world, but just kind of general life teachers anyway. And, you know, from our time at Henzo Gracie's, and thank you to Henzo and everybody over there in New York that helped us out. And, you know, our times traveling around the gyms in the UK and, you know, GB Top Team and Renegade. And I've had some fascinating conversations with some really interesting and inspiring teachers. And your questions kind of brought me around to just a quick shout out to Mr. McLaren. I hope he's still with us, but I would be surprised. But he was one of those teachers that left a very lasting impact on me, not for any other reason other than he just made me really love something that I probably wouldn't have been that interested in otherwise. And I have this memory of him playing out the Battle of Hastings in 1066, and he gets an arrow in the eye and he falling across the tables at the front of the class and, you know, trying to pull this arrow out of his eye. And he was just a fascinating individual. So that's anything where people came face to face in a life or death situation. I've got loads of books on the Colosseum. You know, there's lots of really interesting books around the Colosseum and around the gladiator schools that used to feed talent into the Colosseum, you could say. And, you know, some of the rich people that opted into those schools and gave up everything to become gladiators. Fascinating. You can always learn a lot from people that have passed. And we can always try not to make the same mistakes that they've made. All right. Should we leave it there? Thank you, everybody, for joining us for the live stream. I'm going to be doing these regularly, so make sure you put it in your calendars for Sunday evenings. I'll be here in this room chatting with you guys on the aftermath. So bring your questions, bring your rum for rum Sundays, and I'll see you next time.